Here we go. How many years of training is required as a monk to get some kind of foothold in the Dhamma? Depends. Some are fast tracks, some are slow coaches. So it does not matter. No one knows when you start. Sometimes some people get it very quickly. There was this monk, he was 120 years of age when he became a monk. And that's, he ordained 120, he became enlightened, fully enlightened about 3 months later, and 3 months later he passed away. It's called leaving it to the last moment. And other people, you got like the, one of the famous Buddhist monks, a cousin of the Buddha, Anuruddha. It took him 17 years to become a stream winner, and he became one of the most famous monks. So sometimes it takes a long time, sometimes a short time. So it really, really depends. And so you never know. Give it a try. Who knows? Ajahn Sumedho and Jack Kornfield both trained under Ajahn Chah, but also teach differently to you. Can you please explain why? Jack Kornfield was only with Ajahn Chah for 3 months. He wasn't with him very long. And so, but you know, he uses that to say that he was the disciple of Ajahn Chah, but not really that long. And there was many people, even Devadatta. He was with the Buddha for many years, and he didn't teach the same as the Buddha. So in other words, that some people teach one way, some people teach the other way. But the interesting thing was at the end of Ajahn Chah's life, at his funeral ceremony, there was a discussion. What did Ajahn Chah actually teach? And it wasn't so much a discussion as an argument. And it was fascinating to listen to this. And one people said he taught this, and one people said that. And it was the good old Ajahn Jacaro, my predecessor here. You know, he's a really, I really respect him a lot. He came up and said, you know, there's as many Ajahn Chahs as there are monks who studied under him. That's a very wise thing. Stopped all the arguments. Because what does Ajahn Brahm teach? You ask different people and you won't agree. So, what happens is that we hear what we want to hear. We remember what's important to us. And what challenges us, what we don't really like, we tend to sort of just push that away for a little bit. So this is interesting just about that. But recently, I was visited an old friend, a monk called Ajahn Jayasaro, and it just happened I had a free afternoon when I was in Thailand last year. So I said, let's go and see Ajahn Jayasaro. So he was free. So he wanted to see me as well because he was finishing off a English biography of Ajahn Chah. Not a translation of the Thai one, but just adding new material, a bit of material here, a bit of material there. So he wanted to pick my brain because I was with Ajahn Chah longer than Ajahn Sumedho was. And I was there for 9 years. And that was a time when Ajahn Chah was really able to teach. And then just after I left, that's when he had a stroke. Not my fault. But we were talking and I said, did Ajahn Chah teach jhanas? Of course he did. He called it from the Abhidharma term Apana Samadhi. So, sometimes you don't know what you're looking for. You don't notice it. Yeah, of course he taught jhanas. And number two, I asked him, how was the jhanas related? This is Ajahn Jayasaro, just to check my memory of what Ajahn Chah used to teach. How did he actually teach, right, insight coming? I know he said that there is two times you can get insight. It's called the Upachara Samadhi. That's another Abhidharma term, commentary term. That is just before you enter the jhanas and just after you enter the jhanas. That's when the five hindrances are overcome temporarily. Those are the two places, because the five hindrances, you know, which stop you being wise, which, you know, just change the way you look at things, you know, just according to your desires and will and stuff, that because that they are overcome those two times, just before and just after. And then Ajahn Jayasaro said, but it's the one after the jhanas, that's where people get the insights, because just before it's too unstable and it doesn't last as long, hasn't got as much power. And I was just really impressed, because hey, that's what I teach. You can ask the monks here, that's exactly how I teach. You know, that the just after jhanas, five hindrances are gone, that is the best time. That's basically the only time you get really deep insights. The insights which cause you to be enlightened. And so, but you can get it beforehand, but the five hindrances, they are just suppressed. They're not there just before jhanas, but why on earth you just don't get into the jhanas and really bash them? No, that's a really aggressive. Really suppress them for a long period of time. It doesn't make any sense to me. Of course you get into the jhanas, and it's afterwards you get the deep insights. And I said, I actually put my hand up. I said, yeah, that's how I teach too. And that was coming from Ajahn Jayasaro, who, in order to publish that book, had to go through all the old tapes, so much stuff. He spent how many years doing that? 4 or 5 years or something. It was just, you know, sometimes I think I just see these things for myself. But I say, sometimes you're brainwashed. You don't remember the time when Ajahn Chah said that, but that's how I've been teaching for years and years. So that's good. So that's how Ajahn Chah taught as well. How do I deal with negative emotions such as fears, worries, stress of lay life? I tried metta and the none of my business technique, but some negative emotions persist. How to stop negative emotions draining my positive energy? With metta, easy, I told it to a couple of people, is the negative emotions, they feed on the fears, worries and stress of lay life. So what do you do with those fears and stresses? You can't hide them, you can't bury them, you've got to acknowledge them. So you have to bring them up to the surface. And the best way of doing that, as I told a couple of people today, is to write them on a piece of paper. And so you write them on a piece of paper so they can see, you know, what the problem was. And the thing is, the best piece of paper to use, and it's very, very cheap, in abundant supply, is called toilet paper. You can get a whole roll. We have heaps of those. I know if you go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, and you know, for the lunch, people give us so much food, but they're very kind. They look at both ends of the digestive cycle. They also give us heaps of toilet paper as well. We've got heaps of toilet paper over there. And so we got some spare, and you can write on the toilet paper just all the negative emotions, fears, worries, stress, lay life, all the stuff which people did to you and the stuff which you did. So you write it on a piece of toilet paper. But the most important part is the colour of the ink, which has to be brown or dark brown is the best. And when you write that on the piece of toilet paper in dark brown ink, all the stuff which, you know, is the makes these negative emotions and stress and stuff, all the things you're afraid might happen, all the things, the way you were mistreated, the way you were just overworked, whatever it is, you write it down in brown ink, and you make what we call, in psychology, the association with the other stuff which is brown, which goes on toilet paper. Now, you know, Buddhists are usually very insensitive to the environment. They really look after, you know, whatever as much as possible. But even the people who work in Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, Save the Forest, not any one of them I've seen, when they use the toilet paper, they only use one side. They don't fold it up to use the other side afterwards. It's so wasteful with toilet paper. What about you? If you just got a tiny bit of brown on the toilet paper, do you fold it up and keep it for tomorrow? You wasteful, you know, forest destroyers. No one. You just get a tiny bit of brown and you throw it away. Because, you know, it stinks. So So that's why you make the association. All this brown stuff you've got on this toilet paper, all the stuff which people have done to you, and blah, 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 blah. Write it on a brown, in brown ink, toilet paper, and it makes the association. This is not the sort of material you should carry around with you. There's only one place this belongs. So, having written it out, read it, you do the ceremony. And we have a particular shrine to perform that ceremony. And people do say that they sit on the throne. They call it the shrine room. I call it the letting grow room. And so, you go in there, and before you sit down, you read it again once more and say, now, where should this go? So, you very mindfully, compassionately put it in the bowl. And then you do the last part of the ceremony. There's a little button on the top, and you push that, and it goes to where it belongs, in the sewers. So that is the how you deal with negative emotions. Of course, them, all the stuff which people did to you, all the stuff you're carrying around, let it go, for goodness sake. And that's the best place to let it go. Anyway, please don't try it too much here, though, because otherwise we get our plumbing all stuffed up. Wait till you go home, it's a good time. Or the airport's a good... How does a trance medium work? I don't know, it seems to work. I think what it is they say that they can now connect. A lot of time people in trance, it's as if somebody else comes into their body for a little while. Only for a little while, and then they leave afterwards. And so some people are just, you don't have to do that. Sometimes that people can't get in your body at all. Well, a few times you've seen people actually have got someone possess their body just for a little while. And then once the job is done, then they leave. So anyway, it's only a small thing. But anyway, that's trances, mediums. Some of those mediums are totally accurate and some are not. That's why, you know, you can't really trust them. Is it okay to skip the morning chanting? Of course you can skip during the morning chanting. That's what you meant, didn't you? Give a bigger skip. Is that what you meant? It's quite, you know, so common to do skippy meditation. No, I won't ask you to do that. Kangaroo walking meditation. Did anyone find, because, you know, I usually demonstrate Australian kangaroo walking meditation, but the last time was I was in Penang just before Christmas, and they said, well, how do you do that? And I was looking around, there was no nuns there to exploit. So I had to do it myself. It is karma. You know, I asked other people to do it, and eventually you have to do it yourself. So I did my kangaroo walking meditation. It's on YouTube somewhere. Does anyone know where it is? Has anyone seen that? It's in Penang. Oh, you know where it is. Okay. Sorry? YouTube, but what's the link? Is it? Ajahn Brahm Kangaroo. So if you want to know how to skip meditation, it's on there somewhere. We're looking at it the other day. We couldn't find it. Maybe you can actually look for that later on. Can I skip the morning chanting and breakfast if I can continue to sit in meditation during the time? Of course you can. So the chanting is not obligatory. The breakfast is not obligatory. Even the lunch is not obligatory. Yeah, you can just fast. It's good fun. I also realise that I don't need so much intake of food now, so I would like to cut down on breakfast, certainly. No problem whatsoever. So you just, you know, check your body, check your mind. If it's okay, fine. Hey, what's this? Must be a double question? No. Strong individualism in North America. Example, students at school don't even share a bag of chips. Wow, that is really gross. You know, it was the English custom where I grew up. If you had, you know, the bag of chips, they called them French fries over there, that you always offer someone a chip. And you know, people have seen me do that, you know, that you know, in some sort of maybe a restaurant or somewhere, you have some chips, you offer it to somebody else. It's English tradition. And was with this fellow in the hospice once. He'd been in a coma for a few days. This is the terminal lucidity example. His name was Ted, from Lancashire. His daughter married an ex-monk, so he was there as well. So, the family had known them a long time. And, we're waiting for them to die. And, those of you who've been to sitting by the bedside, he was supposed to die early in the morning, but he went there, did some chanting and stuff, but no, he was just still there, in a coma, wasn't moving at all. And it was getting time to my lunch. And it was, they said, I better get you some lunch. He didn't have any choice. He got some fast food from next door. It's the next best thing to fasting, getting fast food. And so it included some chips, the French fries, the ultra chips. And because this whole family were, from Northern England, she offered the food to me and I was tucking into it. And she also had some herself. And she just normally said just it was the English tradition. Now, even though the dad had been in a coma for I don't know how many hours, Dad, would you like a chip? And he opened his eyes and said, yeah. And that was the last word he spoke. And he died a few minutes later. No, I didn't even get the chip. It's just a bit too late. But it's amazing, just the lucid dreaming. Not the lucid dreaming, the terminal lucidity. The last, his last words before he left this earth. Yeah, I'll have a chip. That's so funny. But anyway, so of course we share, even almost in death. Sharing everything together in Asia. Fight over the restaurant bills, even share information about their salary. And, sharing everything together in Asia. Yeah, you share everything. You share all the gossip. That's what you do in Asia. You share everything with gossip. Have you heard about that man, what he did? Have you heard about what Auntie was doing? And fight over the restaurant bills, even share information about the salary. Both extreme being corruptions. What is the middle way? I like the sharing everything together. That's the best. That's what we have to do as monks. We say, even the content of our bowls, we share with our fellow monastics. Share everything. So that's why sometimes people, they go and offer things. You see them offer it to the senior monk. But they just pass it down the line. So whatever you offer to me, share with everyone else. So don't take any personal gifts. It's all shared. That's wonderful when you do that. So it's given to a sangha, not to an individual monk. That's the very best. So we share everything. Okay, and it's much nicer to share things. I really like that idea. My understanding is that a person who passes away gets reborn within approximately 49-day period. However, mediums seem to be able to contact the spirit of the passed away person many years after death. What is your view on this? Well, if that's your view, the best thing to do is actually to find out by personal experience. So? No, you don't need to die to know these things. It's when I was in Thailand, 49-day period. People say, that was Mahayana or even Tibetan Buddhism. But when one of the interesting things which happened, all these stories, anecdotes, living in these places, that there was the treasurer's, one of his daughters, a big family. He got cancer. He's only quite young, but just very aggressive, and she eventually died of it. Did so well, never complained, was meditating, so she's a really good person. But when she died, I knew the day she died because it was the treasurer of the monastery, and I knew him very well. And so we knew the day he died, and we did the funeral for them. And it was a few weeks later, he came to monastery really early in the morning, the first available car to get to the monastery. He said, what are you doing? You're really early today. He said, well, I had to come straight away because a weird thing happened last night. He said, what happened? Because when they say weird things, I'm really interested. So what happened? And he said, well, we're all, having our breakfast. Where we share things, all sitting around, many little plates sharing. And then one of my daughters, he said, another daughter, there's about 14 or 15 people in the house. One of my daughters said, I had a really strange dream last night. I dreamt that my deceased sister came to me in my dream and said, I've spent enough time now, I'm taking leave, I'm going. And he said, at that, everybody around the floor, you know, around the mats eating, they all stopped, put their, usually just fingers, clean their fingers, and they just all said the same. They each had exactly the same dream that same night, including the treasurer and his wife. About 14 or 15 people had exactly the same dream. Their deceased sister came to them and took leave and said, it's time for me to go now. And it was such a coincidence, everybody. They came to see me straight away and said, what's going on? I said, she's come to take leave, what do you think? But then, because I knew all the timing, I quickly got the calendar out, and it was exactly 49 days since the time she died. And, you know, because I knew it was roughly about that time, but it was exactly, perfectly. So, that was a really good case of a 49-day period staying there. Not 40, 49 days. I don't know why 49, but that's that particular case, and that's what they usually say, 49 days. But, you know, sometimes they contact people longer than that time, because sometimes people get stuck for a while, because, you know, there's things which they haven't done. There was Poonsup and George. Now, Poonsup was a Thai Chinese. Her husband George was Chinese. So they got married living in Perth. And, is that the only one really from the olden days, that George was really, really, I mean, actually, he'd been, how his wife, Poonsup, will be in trouble these days, really domestic abuse. She was always criticizing me in public. George, you stupid man, come over here. George, you hopeless case. And this is in public, always, I felt so sorry for George. But you know, after she died, I thought, oh, are you glad she's gone? No, I miss her. It's really weird, you know, you get so used to people scolding you and telling you off in public that he missed her after she died. Crazy people. So anyway, she came up to me, she was getting very sick and dying. Oh, she was also the one, just a few little stories here. Okay. She was also the one we used to do holy water, and she was really sick, so I gave a whole bucket of holy water every week. I mean, honestly, it was an 11-litre bucket. You know, I blessed it for her and she took it away. I thought she needed that to get better. Until, I did that for weeks and weeks, until that I got a call from a Chinese gentleman. He said, Ajahn Brahma, I want to buy some holy water. I said, we don't buy it, we give it. He said, no, you sell it. I said, we never sell that. Yes, you do. I get my supply from Miss Poonsup Wong. I want to cut out the middleman. Oh, I've been conned. It was her scam. She's getting the whole bucket and bottling it and setting it on. She's making a little fortune. China is very good, very good, very popular, you know. But so anyway, that when she got very, very sick, about to die, she said, I can't trust my stupid husband. She really called him stupid. So she said, I've got to propose this deal for you. She said, because I don't think he can really do my funeral service properly, because he's so stupid, so I don't trust him at all. So, can the Buddhist Society of West Australia do the service, and I will bequeath the half the apartment in Maylands. Not so the best suburb, but, you know, it was, you know, worth a lot of money. I can't do that deal. That's worldly. So I told the committee, and the committee met together. They knew roughly the value of the apartment and how much a funeral was, and they said, well, yeah, you know, we got really on behalf of, you know, what we're supposed to be doing, looking after the temple. Yes, certainly, okay, we accept that. So they accepted that, and then a few months later, she passed away. I organized a funeral for her. The Buddhist Society temple paid all the bills. And of course, after it was all finished, you know, we didn't go up to George and say, okay, now cough up. You know, he was grieving his wife, surprisingly, but he was grieving her. And, very honestly. But then, you know, we just casually asked him. He said, you know, have you found the will yet? He said, I know, I've been looking for it everywhere, I can't find it anywhere. And so, you know, we didn't press him. Okay, whenever it turns up, let us know. Now, we're Buddhists, you know, we've got to be kind and not think about money, but be kind. And then he came to Bodhinyana Monastery in a taxi early one morning. And it cost a lot of money coming in taxis. What are you coming in a taxi for? You know, I'll be going to Nonamara next week. No, I've got to come now. The will, here it is. Take it. I said, you found it? He said, yeah. And he was really distraught. So what happened? He said, well, Poonsak, my wife, she came last night as a ghost. George, you know where that will is. Give it now. And honestly, that's absolutely true. And I've never seen a person so scared in my life. He could not give me that will quick enough so that he wouldn't be harassed. It's bad enough being harassed by his wife when he was alive, but when she harasses him as a ghost, oh, there's no escape. So that was, because she hung around to make sure that everything was done properly. So anyway, that's sometimes. And contact a person after many, many years after death, that's usually, you can't do that. It's just too long. How can I deepen and stay with my breath, even though my mind ebbs and flows between thought, silence, and breath? I'm beginning to understand what you mean by overvaluing of thoughts. What can be done to undermine this misplaced value? Thank you. Well, don't think about thoughts. Otherwise, that's more thoughts. The thoughts, the little exercises, even when you are eating, you taste the food. You don't think about what you're going to do this afternoon when you have your lunch. When you drink, you feel every taste of that tea or that sort of water or juice which you drink. You know, you don't have a commentary when you're eating. You just feel it and taste it to the max. It's very, very pleasant. And it's the same when you go for a walk, even between here and your hut. You don't go around talking to people. You just feel the cool air afterwards. And if it's the evening time, and again, I ask people, please, if you can, don't wear your shoes so you can actually walk barefoot. You can feel the cold of the concrete. And you can feel just the wet softness of the snake before it bites. No, not this time of night. So what it does is actually you become more alive. So you feel rather living thoughts. And again, just sitting out with a cup of tea, just watching the trees grow. You know, learn the beauty of silence. There's so many opportunities to be quiet and silent here. So that's one of the reasons why we try to keep that noble silence, not to talk so much. If you stop talking with your mouth, it's much easier to stop thinking, you know, the internal talk. Then little by little, you get to really appreciate silence. And I gave the simile in an interview, not really in public here, that you know that if any of you like, especially classical music, and you go to a concert, imagine you're listening to a classical concert by Ajahn Brahms. Brahms lullaby or whatever. No, by some sort of, you know, very beautiful music. Imagine if during the music you start talking to your friend. You say, oh, this is a very good concert, you know, that violin is just so good. And it's one of the best performances of like Mozart I've ever heard. If you start talking about that in the middle of the concert, you get thrown out. Because you can't talk and appreciate the music at the same time. And that's like a nice simile, so you appreciate just what's happening in this moment. Like a beautiful concert. Amazing symphonies. And then you appreciate that so much, you understand the value of silence. And that means that silence becomes really nice, and you just try and stay there as much as you possibly can. Until, you know, you get quite used to it. Today at lunch I was offered a food that I knew would not agree with me, but took it because the woman seemed so joyful when I took it. Then an hour later in meditation, my belly growled like fireworks, disturbing all those around me. Stayed feeling the humility of growling noises. Finally, when I stopped, whipping myself to focus on the woman's joy, the noises subsided. How do monks deal with eating what only offered without choices? Oh, that, you know, sometimes that used to be, very often people offer things to us. So what we do these days, and sometimes it was the case, they put it in and say, oh, you must eat it, Ajahn Brahm. I'm special, I made this for you specially. And so, oh yeah, okay. And then you get sick. So what we do now, you can see if you go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, you know that we put it on the tables, and it's all offered, the whole buffet is offered, and then we send all the lay people out. Get out. We've got to do that, otherwise they stay around the table, and then they see, you know, it's 1 minute later, and say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, this is for really, I made a special for you. Forget about other people's stuff, this is my stuff. So that's why we get people out of the way, and then we can actually take the food which is suits us. Otherwise, it's just, you know, it gets hopeless. But then, don't do this, because, you know, these are the tricks which people get into, because, you know, they see, because they want to offer it specially to you. They come late, on purpose. So they can't put it on the table, and they come, I said, I'll offer this later. So they come and offer it to you personally, and then they look. But fortunately, we've got a big bowl, so we can put it in the bowl. They don't know what we eat. So, you know, it goes on another part of the bowl. Thank goodness. So you try to accept things and be kind to people. But, you know, so many monks, it's give offer to the Sangha. And different monks eat different things. So that's great. So you can actually, everything gets sort of eaten. So that's how it works. So it is actually true that sometimes that people think, you know, that, so now it's good that you have some idea of how monks feel. And nuns as well. So, quite seriously, those of you who serve the monks and nuns here, and a few other tables, just have a look at them and say, you know, to them, do you want this? And if you want, if they pass, please let them pass. It may be your favourite food, but not for them. So otherwise, the monks and nuns get very sick. And that really sort of, out of kindness, they sacrifice their tummy for you. Can one reach jhana during walking meditation? Wouldn't she fall down? You wouldn't fall down, just hit the wall. And I always thought that was totally impossible to get into jhana as a walking meditation. Quite close by, I see Nimittas, but apparently that somebody said there was a monk who got into jhana while walking meditation. And the proof was he had all these cuts and band-aids all over his face. Because in the jhanas, you have no, you're right inside the mind having a beautiful, beautiful time, fully aware, but you're not aware of your body. You're inside. So, of course, you just carry on walking and you just go into the wall here. But that's a little bit better than just to do walking meditation outside. Because if you do walking meditation outside and go to jhanas, then you just keep going straight down the hill, over the freeway, over the fields, and end up in the Indian Ocean. So the point is, if ever you are walking meditation and you start to get very still, you start getting nimittas coming up, just come in here and just sit down. Or as some people did in the old days, they would actually sit down right where they were walking meditation. Sit down right there, just, you know, getting very peaceful, very still, not to oasis. They just go down, sit down, and just carry on meditating from there. Is that true that people in professions like musicians, artists, software developments, who are used to intense concentration in their work, find it easier to concentrate and combine with letting go to reach jhana quicker? Nope. Software engineers. I think there's a software developer who asked this question. Hopeful. So they're used to intense concentration. Intense concentration is not the way. It's actually learning how to let go. There was some people, and they were like athletes, dancers, musicians again. But it was the simile of getting into the zone. because there's one of the old monks who was here, disrobed some time ago, see him every now and again, because he was from Perth, and he married an Indian classical dancer, and he was actually a musician, he even performed something recently in the Perth Concert Hall, so he's really quite talented. But his wife was one of the top classical dancers on the front cover of glossy magazines in India, really famous. And so when, the day after they got married, I came and saw me, and I just was asking her, I said, well, how do you perform to such a high level? I just forget what her name was. I don't know her name, but maybe something she's just teaching now. You may have known her, because she's a very famous Indian dancer. But anyway, she said that practice, 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 putting in the hours, but when she performs, she forgets everything she's ever been taught and just lets it happen. It's what they call like getting into the zone. Well, you disappear. You vanish. You don't control the steps. It just happens. And just also with great musicians, that's what they do. Sometimes they just practice, 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 but when they perform, they vanish and disappear. And just allow it to happen. And it just goes so smoothly. It's not in the zone. And there's no effort there at all. It just, the fingers play the music. And you're not doing anything. That, I can understand from meditation and stuff. You get in the zone and it just comes. So that's really good. Not many musicians, anything. It's not intense concentration, it's the ability to let go. Train, 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 but then let go and see what happens. What is mental formation? Is that the same as mind states or sankhara? Can you give examples of it? How are they different from feelings, moods or perceptions? This is what's called the five components of existence, otherwise known as the khandhas. It's one way of separating out the stuff which makes up a human being. Just for example, you see our rows we have these little sections here and tram lines in between. It's supposed to be based on the paddy fields in Magadha, just outside of Rajagaha, where the Buddha was staying. And each one of these sections of a monk's robe, there have to be 5, 7 or 9, sometimes even more sections, they're all called khandhas, sections. That's just what it means. So I think this one is a 9-khandha section robe. It just means sections, that's all. How you divide up a human being. So, in the 5 sections, and the first one is the body. But it's not just body, it's the stuff of the universe as well. This is, Rupa Khanda, the body or form or stuff. That's what you have first of all, that's the first khanda. The next one is called Vedana, usually translated as feeling, but feeling is a word which sometimes means emotions. What this really means is actually the experience for any of the 6 senses. Yes, they sometimes say pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or in between, but it's not the affective quality, whether it's delightful or not delightful. It is a fact of experience. You just make it those 3 just to give an idea of what you're talking about. Basic experience of life, of sensory experience. That is called Vedana. It's experienced. And the next one is perception. How we perceive what we experience, how we interpret it. And this is where, as a monk, you get very unromantic when you notice that where people fall in love. If you go out with, someone you're romantically attached to, where do you go for a nice romantic evening? It was a walk by the river in the moonlight. That's romantic. Or a candlelit dinner. That's romantic. Or a dark nightclub. That's romantic. And there's many other places where you have romance blossoms. But I notice the common feature in all romantic places. Dark. So why do you have to be dark to be romantic and fall in love? Because in the flickering candlelight, that ordinary looking girl in front of you becomes this supermodel, your dream fantasy woman. And the guy just looks so, just, you know, whoever you feel is just, you know, your dream guy, like Bruce Willis or I haven't got a clue. Who's a, or Leonardo DiCaprio? I haven't got a clue. These people are like, anyway. But anyway, you know, you can fantasize and dream because it's so uncertain. You can make what you see sort of, you know, your fantasy. You can see what you want to see. So yeah, that's how you fall in love. And later on, you get a bit surprised. It's actually not what you committed to. Because usually a few years later you start to see faults and defects. It's the same person, but when you get really in a bad mood, that's what you see. You know, the things which are wrong with the person. The perception, the great story of the two bad bricks in the wall, which I'm not going to repeat, but you know the essence of it. Why is it when you've got a fault-finding mind, you just see the bad bricks and you want to destroy them? Why is it when you're in a good mood? Oh, it's beautiful, wonderful, a brick wall, wonderful. It's your perception is bent, distorted, to see what you want to see. And to even not be able to see what you don't want to see. That's what perception is. And it might be a nice place to put in about insight. Can you trust what you see? What you hear, what you feel, what you know. This was the experiment which Professor Bernard Carr told me about. And I've been spreading it around. It was an amazing little experiment which was done at Imperial College in London. And many of the people in psychic research, you know, metaphysics, parapsychology, whatever you wish to call it, weird stuff, they're highly trained scientists. So, they're not sort of weirdos. This fellow was a student of Stephen Hawking's. So, it wasn't Bernard, it was one of his friends. They said they were going to demonstrate in laboratory conditions levitation. And the person doing the demonstration was well regarded in the scientific community. So you've got all his professors and lecturers, trained experimental scientists, to come into this lecture theatre in Imperial College London to witness levitation. They had cameras pointing in all directions to record it if it worked and to be able to see if there's any funny business and any sort of tricks. So, had all these top scientists were there, an experimenter came into the lecture theatre carrying a pot plant to show no wires, just a pot plant, and put it on the bench. And said, turned on all the cameras, said, now we're going to demonstrate levitation. And of course, most people thought this was crazy. You know, it goes against the law of gravity. So anyway, he said, but I need your help to be able to create the right atmosphere. I want you all to start chanting Om. And his first great achievement was to get all these crusty old professors, you know, and lecturers and top scientists sitting there going, Om, Om, Om. And as they were chanting Om, it worked. Our flower pot rose above the table quite a few inches. And they photographed it. They saw it. It happened. It was real. And afterwards, they asked many of those professors, and some of them, what are you talking about? It never rose. It was on the table all the time. It never rose at all. It never levitated. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment. Because The truth of the matter was, underneath that bench, they put this huge, powerful electromagnet. And when the current was turned on, if you put so much current through a machine, the current hums. They had to get everybody to chant Om, you know, to hide the current, to mask it, so it would get found out. It was a trick. But that wasn't the point. The point was that flower pot actually rose above the table. But some people just couldn't see it. And these were trained observers, scientists, who thought they were objectively just noticing what was happening. But before it even came to their consciousness, they blocked it off because it just couldn't happen. Levitation was impossible. It can't exist. Therefore, the evidence of it actually appearing before their eyes was blocked off. Never even came to their conscious awareness. So much for bare attention. Even bare attention, by the time you're aware of it, it's been filtered. That's why the hindrances, those are the things which filter the attention. That's why you fall in love with someone, the next one, why did I marry that guy for? I must have been crazy. It's the same guy. You just see him through a different prism, different perspective. So that's what mental formation. Oh, that's the perceptions. And then you got the mental formations. That's mostly will and what you create with your will. Formed by will. So that's why people can will all sorts of things. I mentioned to you the touching the flesh with a 4-inch nail at room temperature because the person was hypnotized. They not only screamed in pain, but a blister came up. The will created a wound. The will can uncreate a wound. It's amazing, just the power of this thing which we call will. Great stuff. People actually give up the will to live. Nothing wrong with them. They die. Sometimes I've seen people, they should be dead in hospital, but their son from New York hasn't arrived yet. And the son comes in from New York, says hello to his dad, and then 10 minutes later walks out and dies. Keep themselves alive. It's important to be able to see their son. Will is very, very strong. And the last one is consciousnesses, 6 of them. So the Sankara, the will. Today I was sitting by the lake at your monastery. I was still. Soon, 2 kangaroos appeared on the other side of the lake. I remained still, so as not to scare them away. Then a monk walked within a couple of meters of the kangaroos. They remained calm and stayed. Guess they were used to humans. Material for a new simile. Nah, that's ordinary. Those kangaroos, they think they own the place sometimes. It's true, you know, sometimes they get in the way. You know, you try to walk to your hut and they're just in the middle of the path. You have to walk around them. So, no, I'm the abbot here, not you. They don't. They're totally disrespectful, those kangaroos. Ooh. But kangaroo stories, you know that sometimes the monks, they have their bowl, they take their bowl and they go back to their hut and retreat. So you take the bowls back. You see a few monks do that even now. And just they eat in their huts for a bit more seclusion, the solitude. So it happened to me, you have to be very careful, you take your bowl inside. If you leave it outside, I've done this, other monks have done that, you leave it outside just for a few seconds, you go inside to get something, when you come out again, the kangaroo's got his nose in your bowl, eating your lunch. Sneaky things. Well, that's my lunch you're eating. So anyway, sometimes, you're not really supposed to feed the kangaroos, but the kangaroos know who the soft-hearted monks are. And so we've done that. So one day, I had lots of food left over when I was on retreat, so I put some out there. Some nice healthy foods, a carrot, an apple, a bit of lettuce. But at the bottom of the pile was a slice of pizza. And I saw this kangaroo look at the food I put out there. The apple, nah. The carrot, nah, with his nose. You know what the kangaroo went for? The pizza. It took it in his hands and started chomping the pizza. From that time on, I realized that kangaroos like fast food. They do. Sorry? Oh, Pizza Hut, yeah, as usual. Yeah, but just kangaroos. But, you know, you're not really supposed to, but, you know, I said kangaroos, and I thank you very much. They're very happy. So, anyway, now we get to know these kangaroos. They're very nice. Please, can you tell us a funny story about when you first thought you were enlightened? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Okay, you asked for it. This is about enlightenment. How hard is it to become enlightened? So, this was, I've only been a monk for 4 years in this beautiful monastery. Didn't have to do anything. And so, during the rains retreat, you don't go anywhere, you stay in one place. Spend a lot of time meditating. Really getting ready. You know what it's like? How long have you been here? 5, 6 days? This is 90 days. Really getting into it. And that's really getting into the meditation. And when you really get, you don't feel like you want to sleep. So I was really getting into it late at night doing my walking meditation. And your mind was so clear, so much energy, so much peace. The mindfulness was so strong. And the bliss was really strong. And when this happens, you know, it just, you know, you don't go looking for insights. You don't go contemplate. So they just come to you. And just like under the mango tree of Ajahn Chah, these mangoes were just falling, like raining on you. Amazing sort of insights. Wow, this is incredible. How come I couldn't see this before? Another insight came and another. And then the big one came. The mammoth one. Wow. That was just so incredible. That was it. Amazing, and just amazing, just bliss and peace. Another arahat that arose in this world. That was just such a wonderful feeling. And then, we used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was about 2 o'clock, and I just thought, oh, you might go just stretch out. So you stretched out, you know where you go to sleep. So much bliss and peace, no tiredness at all. You just lay down for about 10 or 15 minutes and you got up again and you went to sit in the hall. And, you know, sometimes it's really hot. You were malnourished over there. And, you know, a lot of time people were sleepy. You know, you see how people sleep here in the morning. And, you know, I was just so clear. Just such amazing posture. Easy. You didn't have to go and just, you know, watch the breath. It just, the breath was right there. Nimittas, the whole works. The chanting was just so clear and powerful. Not sadhus, like a really big chanting. So much energy. And then you went on the alms round in the village. Just people put some rice, if you were lucky, a banana. That's actually, if not if I was lucky, if they were lucky, because making merit to a newly arisen arahat was such a wonderful thing. And I was zapping them with loving kindness. You don't know how lucky you are to give rice today. And I was just really high on the arms around and just blasting people with loving kindness. And we're all making so much merit. You're so fortunate, you people. And then, then I got back into the monastery. Now, the usual food every day was, you know, the sticky rice, the glutinous rice, which you've got on arms round, and rotten fish curry. I used to be a vegetarian before I ordained, but, you know, there's no vegetables there. So it was rotten fish curry. They used to call it rotten fish curry because they would collect the fish during the monsoon season and they put it in a bottle and just leave it there to ferment. And the example I tell is absolutely true. In the monastery, we're cleaning up around the kitchen, doing our chores, and I found one of these bottles was left outside. And it's only just like plastic was on the outside to sort of protect. The plastic had been perforated And so the flies that got inside, it was caught in with maggots, this rotten fish. So I went to throw it away. And as I was going to throw it away, the head man of the village was visiting. He was elected as the head man because he was the most intelligent, experienced, refined of all those lay people. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, it's got, you know, maggots and the fun." I said, "What are you talking about throwing it away? That's extra protein. Give it to me."
Yeah.
And that's what we ate the next day. And it was gross and it stank. But, you know, you got used to it after a while. You know, it's just subsistence. Economy, you just ate whatever was there. And so, you know, there was that, the rotten fish curry was there, stank, but you know, got used to it. But there was another pot there that morning, and that was really, you know, weird, uncommon. What's another pot of curry doing there today? And that was like a pork curry. And that was actually from town somewhere, that was actually edible. You know, the other stuff was just really awful. But, you know, you got used to it. But this was actually quite delicious. And you know what I thought? I thought, wow. The heavenly beings, wherever they are, also want to make merit with a new arahat. That's the only explanation, because it's never happened. You get, you know, something nice to eat. You know, like past celebrate. So I think, wow, all the heavenly beings, whoever provided this, you know, my blessings to you. You're so lucky. So, we lined up there, you know, just actually sitting down. In those days, the pots were passed down. We had our rice and just the two pots. And the abbot, I was number two monk there, the abbot of that monastery. You know, that was his village, that's where he was born. I know that's what he grew up on, the rotten fish curry. You know, that's what I thought he would like. But did he take any of the rotten fish curry? No. He took this incredible whopping ladle of the pork curry. Not one, but three. Jeez, no way could anyone eat that much. Greedy pig. And then, I didn't mind, there's plenty left. What he did next was just unforgivable. Now, what was left in the rotten fish curry saucepan, he poured all into the rotten fish curry and stirred it up. Saying, Mern Gun, means in Thai, all the same, all the same. And I thought, bloody hypocrite. What do you mean, all the same? If it was all the same, why did you take yours first? And then mix it all up. You know, that's not fair. And I was really upset. His hypocrisy, his greed. And that's when I realized, arahats don't care about such things. Arahats don't get upset. And I just got upset. And I realized I wasn't really an arahat after all. Now, if ever that's happened to you, you've thought you're totally enlightened, you find out you're not. After that, you don't care what you eat. Slaughtered, oh God, here you go. That was so depressing. So that was my enlightenment. It didn't last that long. It was great when it lasted, only about 6 hours, 7 hours. Wonderful. So that is what happened. If you think you're enlightened, you usually get tested out pretty quickly. If you get upset, you realize you're not. Never mind. Anyway, dear Ajahn, after passing away, the Buddha was not reborn again. So where did he go? Went nowhere. Poof, disappeared. So the answer to that question that was from the Aggiwachagota Sutta, it was the Buddha with this wanderer, Wachagota, he was asking similar questions. When someone gets enlightened, where do they go? So the Buddha said, see the oil lamp. He actually said it was a fire, but I use the oil lamp simile. See an oil lamp, the flame on that lamp. So what causes it? And it's a combination of the oil, the wick, and the heat. You've got the oil, the wick, and the heat, then you get a flame. If for one reason one of those causes is taken away, the oil is all exhausted, the wick is burnt out, or the heat is blown away, then the flame just goes out. And that's when the Buddha asked Washigota, said, well, where does the flame go? Once it's been blown out, or there's no more wick, or the oil has been all used up, where does the flame go? If it's been a really good flame, is it, does it go to heaven realms where all the flames, they burn, you know, just nice and peacefully forever after? Or if they've been bad flames, they go into hell realm and burn people and cause all the pain. Where the flames? He actually said, does it go to the east, west, north, south, up or down? What do you go, what are you talking about? Flame doesn't go anywhere. It's just been extinguished, that's all. And the Buddha said exactly the same. This person we call a person, the five components of existence, is just body, experience, perception, will, consciousnesses. When one of those, or a couple of those, get taken away, then you're gone. You don't go anywhere. And you know the word for a flame being extinguished? Nibbana. The flame nibbutas. That's the past participle. So every kid in the villages of India at that time knew exactly what the word nibbana meant. Mummy, the flame is nibbana'd. Be careful, it's going to nibbana if you don't close the window soon. That's what it meant. Oof. It's gone. It doesn't go anywhere. But isn't that annihilation? Of course not. There's nothing there to begin with. Just a combination of, for the flame, just three things. Just the heat, the wick, and the oil, that's all. So, I notice every now and again you find in modern culture people get a bit of insight. And I remember that when Princess Diana died, at least Elton John understood. A candle in the wind, and she knew back. I don't know that song, but anyway, something like that, anyway. I don't think she departed. But anyway, the flame went out. Can you say more about compassion? Is it loving kindness to myself and to others? Do we need to build boundaries with other people in order to protect ourselves? You have to say sometimes no, for the sake of all other beings. I mentioned that today at interviews. When people try to catch the Buddha out, he's not really in mind. So this guy, Mara, you know, sneaking up and trying to find any faults. And one day, after a nice lunch, hot weather, he caught the Buddha laying down, having a siesta after lunch. Ha ha ha, caught you. Who do you think you are? You're a Buddha, you're sleeping, that's indulgent. You know, other people are working hard as you're sleeping today to feed you, and you're just laying down, you know, you lazy Buddha. And what the Buddha said, he said, what are you doing that for? And the Buddha said, for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. When I read that, I was, wow. And he really meant that, out of compassion and kindness. By example, and also being old at that time, to be able to relax, rest, so he could teach other people afterwards. You look after yourself so you can look after others. Kind to yourself. So you can be kind to others. You come on retreat out of compassion for all the people who have to put up with you. So at least they're getting 9 days of peace and quiet. But also you're a much better person afterwards. So yeah, I mean, boundaries, it's just like wisdom, kindness. So you're kind to yourself so you can be kind to others. Okay. Story, for those who haven't heard this before, if you've heard it, listen carefully, because this time I'm going to give you a test on this story. People like tests, exams, you know, not that important, but it's a good test. There's 7 monks meditating in the cave. There were 7 monks meditating in a cave on loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well, free from suffering. And in that cave, what you've got to remember is who those monks were. The first monk was the head monk. The second monk was his brother, became a monk as well. The third monk was the best friend. There was also a monk with him. And the fourth monk was the they called them the enemy because this monk, they had personality clashes. They were monks, they were tolerating each other, but you know, some personalities just, you know, so different, you just can't get on. So the fourth monk was an enemy, the enemy, say. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so old, could die any day. The sixth monk was a very ill monk. He was so ill that no one knew who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. And the last monk, number seven, was the useless monk. Every time he meditated, he fell asleep and snored. Every time he took his food, he slurped and burped. Every time he chanted, he was always off key. You know, just, you know, there's always somebody like that. You know, I say every monastery has one. Dharmasaya, you know who that is, don't you? In your mind, you must have one there somewhere. If you don't, I can loan you a couple. But they were allowed to be there. So anyway, the seven monks were there. And one day this band of thieves found that cave in the middle of the jungle. Thought, wow, this is an excellent hideout for us. This is perfect. You know, after we've done our dastardly deeds and robbed and killed and extorted, this is where we can hide out until the heat goes down and the police don't look for us anymore, where we can store all of our stolen goods. This is perfect for us, a hideout. Only one problem, the monks. So they said, well, let's just kill them all. They're really bad people. So they wanted to kill all the monks so that they could use the cave. But the head monk, a very good speaker, should have been a politician or a car salesman. So anyway, the head monk said, look, the only reason why you want to kill us all is to make sure that we don't tell the authorities the location of this cave. We promise you we won't. They said, that's not good enough. How do we know? No, you won't say. And the head monk came up with this suggestion. No, the gang of thieves came up with the suggestion. It was the best the head monk could do. That one of the monks would have to be killed in front of all the other monks, just to show that these thieves were serious. They let all the other monks go, but if any one of those monks let the police know the location of the cave, those thieves will come after, and this is what will happen to you, monks, if you divulge this secret. And that was the best they can do. And the head of thieves is, well, better than just one monk dies and all of you. So, head monk, you choose. So it was a head monk's job to choose who would be sacrificed so all the rest of the monks could go free. So, if you were that head monk, who would you choose? Before you give your answer, hear this list of seven monks again. The head monk himself. The second was his brother, who would do anything for him. Same with a friend. A real friend is a friend who would sacrifice themselves a whole life for you. And the fourth monk was the enemy, always causing problems towards everybody. So maybe an opportunity, you know, to... The fifth monk was a very old monk. He'd lived such a long time. He's going to die anyway. It's just like euthanasia. But not voluntarily. But the other monk. They're going to die anyway soon. The sick monk and the old monk. I just don't know how long they've got. And the last monk, the useless monk. For his whole life being a monk, he'd never done anything of really great use or service. Maybe this was his chance. So, having gone through those seven monks, if you were that head monk, if you know the answer, please don't spoil it. Shh. Who would you choose? Yeah? Anyone for the useless monk? That's what your boss said. Who for the old monk? Well, look, I know we have noble silence, but you can actually say something now. But anyway, look, what usually happens is, the most common answer is people will hand up and say, he sacrificed himself. That's so Western. And of course that is the wrong answer. So if it wasn't himself, who was the right answer?
Paper, scissor, rock.
Brother, sorry?
Paper, scissor, rock.
Oh, paper, scissor, rock. That's new, yeah. No. So the answer is, and one of the times I said this was in Sacramento when I was there, and they had this Episcopalian bishop came to listen to my talk, and because this talk was really useful for him, I asked him, and of course, being a Christian, he said he sacrificed himself. I said, wrong answer. And then when I told him, I said, wow, that's amazing. Can I use that symbol? He said, yeah, go for it. And the answer was, the head monk could not choose, was unable to choose, because his love, his loving kindness towards his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than loving kindness towards his best friend. He even loved his enemy exactly the same, not an iota more. And the dear old monk and the sick monk, he loved them both. And of course, the useless monk. he was not very helpful, but he loved him so much. He was just such a sweet little monk, the useless monk. So he loved all those monks exactly the same. What was most important, he loved himself no more, no less than all the other monks. His love was so equal, indiscriminate, undifferentiated, so equal for all of them, he was literally unable to choose at all. And when I told that story again in Sacramento a couple of years ago in front of the Episcopalian bishop, don't you remember your teacher Jesus saying in the Bible to love your neighbor as yourself? Never said to love your neighbor more than yourself, nor less than yourself, but to love your neighbor as yourself, to love yourself as your neighbor, no more, no less. And that's what he smiled. Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you. But of course, what most people do, they sacrifice themselves, which means you count less than other people. That is not compassion. That's discrimination. So, real loving kindness, to love all beings, including yourself, no more, no less. Isn't that beautiful? So anyway, that's the answer there. That's compassion. As yourself, as others, no more, no less. Can you explain how to become a Buddhist? Well, you have to shave all your hair off. You wear a brown robe. Of course you don't. That one day you just decide to become, that's what Buddhism is, that's what you feel describes you best. How do you become a woman? That's just who you are. Even like if you're gay, if you're heterosexual, transgender, whatever, there's some day you think, that's who I am. That describes me. So, one day you come up and say, oh, I'm Buddhist. That's my philosophy. For me, personally, I got books on different religions. I thought religion was really important. Spirituality was essential in life. But why choose a religion because, everybody else in your family had that same religion? I decided to do what we call market research. Find out the different religions and find out. And as soon as I read a book on Buddhism, I said, well, that's me, that's who I am. That's just how I look at life. So I call myself a Buddhist. That's how you become a Buddhist. Yeah, you can go and just do precepts and go for refuge and stuff like that, but what does that really mean? Sometimes it's on the surface. But, it's on the surface. Yeah, this is who I am. I'm a Buddhist. Do you ever run across the ex who dumped you? I don't run over people. Run across. No, I don't know where she is or whatever. Anyway, does she get good karma for dumping you? Or if I saw her now, thank you. In other words, is the effect of karma stronger than the action, than the intention? Because it was her intention to actually move you towards being a monk. No, she didn't know what she was up to. I didn't know what I was up to. Just good fortune. And sometimes in karma, you go in a circuitous way, but when you look back upon it, oh, it always had a bit of a meaning to it. So It was almost like, not really destiny, because you could interfere with destiny, but a lot of it was just your inclination. And, you know, it was actually probably good, because if she hadn't dumped me, I'd have probably dumped her and I'd become a muck. So, you know, it just, you know, obviously that wasn't meant to be a husband. When a monk or a nun goes to sleep, do they do so in the lion's pose? I don't know. I've never been in the same room when a nun goes to sleep. Do you think I'm a peeping Tom or something? The lion pose is on the right-hand side. And I just train myself. I usually do that. You know, just because, you know, I got used to it. But, you know, sometimes you turn over and you wake up. But one thing which I never do, I never go to sleep on my back. Because I reserve that position for doing meditation. So if ever, you know, I wanted to, you know, to be awake, laying down meditation, I always use my back. It's quite comfortable. So, you know, put my feet down, just lay on my back, and I never go to sleep like that. Because of that, it's almost psychologically, whenever I'm lying on my back, my mind knows, okay, it doesn't want me to go to sleep. I've got to be aware, alert. It's very comfortable. If I want to go to sleep, turn on the side. So that's why doing lying down meditation is okay, but reserve a posture, you know, of lying down meditation, where you never go to sleep. So psychologically, you know, okay, this is meditation time, not sleeping time. On the side, he wants me to go to sleep. Is mindfulness the same as knowing awareness and consciousness? Mindfulness is like knowing. That's mindfulness. No, mindfulness is more the awareness plus knowing the where you're supposed to be aware, what you're supposed to do with it. Because you never really have just mindfulness in Buddhism. It's always mindfulness with wisdom. It's satipanya or sati sampajanya usually. So that's why they always seem to go together. So you know, but you know exactly what, you know, what you're supposed to be doing with what you know. And consciousness, no, it's consciousness is not one consciousness, sight consciousness, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind consciousness. What is absorption mean? It's the same level state as dissolution. No, absorption is one of these really old, way past its used by date terms for jhanas. Simply because, you know, you've got this nimitta and you just go right into it. So they call it absorption. But, you know, it doesn't really make much sense. It is the state of jhanas. And, of course, you know, many things are vanishing at the same time. So, you know, you can say things are disappearing. Please explain the quote by Ajahn Chah: when you have time to be mindful, you have time to meditate. I don't know if that's what he said, because there's so many things attributed to Ajahn Chah which I've never heard before. And it is usually, if you have time to breathe, you have time to meditate. That's what he was saying. Just because sometimes I'm too busy, I haven't got time to actually to meditate. So, you've got time to breathe? Yeah, well, you've got time to meditate. So it's just because people get very, very busy. So what I sometimes say when people say, ask for the best time to meditate, I think I've already said it, when's the best time to meditate? When's the worst time? Later on. And if it's like, you know, the time to meditate, if it's really important to you, it's just like breathing, it's like eating, of course you meditate, because it's like eating. Can you meditate lying down? Yeah, I've just answered that. Very good. But it's just how you lie down. So, is there no place for blame, guilt, or anger in daily life for a lay Buddhist? How should a Buddhist handle receiving that emotion? Just don't blame the person for turning you off. Don't get angry at them. Ugh, boss. And so you don't even receive it. You let it go. Story of... I can do this little story. There's only two questions to go. What are these questions? Just make sure it's not a long question. Okay, I'll do this one quest of all. Okay, I can do this one. The story of one of my friends over in Sydney. Her name is Julie. She has a clothing business, and known her for quite a long time now. And that she had a little daughter called Holly. I named her Surya because, you know, very bright little kid. And she was trying to negotiate a contract with a big firm in London. And, you know, they were negotiating telephone, I think, and I don't know if there was emails then, but anyway, phone calls and stuff. And then the director said, "No, we're ready to sign the contract. Come as soon as you can to London, all the way from Sydney." And it was such a lucrative contract. It was going to, you know, basically move her business up to the next level. So she got on the next available flight to Heathrow. And her good husband, David, was looking after the little daughter, about 3 or 4 years old at the time, I think. So she flew off to Heathrow. And by the time she got to London, she only had time to check into a hotel, have a shower, get changed, and go to the boardroom. She was just so tired and jet-lagged. But this was, you know, a really big deal. She'd done most of the work, negotiations. And she told me when she went into the boardroom, as soon as she walked in there, the directors, the manager hadn't sort of, managing director, the CEO, the boss, hadn't come in yet. And the director said, "Who are you?" And Julie from Sydney, "Oh, you wasted your time. You might as well just go back to Sydney on the next flight. There's no way the boss is going to sign any contract today. He's in a filthy mood. He's just so upset and angry. He's not going to do anything. So you wasted your time. I'm sorry." And Julie said, "Well, I've come all this way. You know, I'm not going to go. I'm going to see the fellow. Suit yourself. You may be in here 10, 15 minutes. We don't know." So anyway, she in the boardroom, she sat down and started meditating. And hers was like loving kindness meditation. She sat there and and just was meditating away. "May all beings be happy and well. All beings be free of suffering." Oh. Getting nice and peaceful. She's a good meditator. And that's when the CEO came in the boardroom. "Who the hell is she? What does she think she's doing in my boardroom?" "Get out." Oh, I'm getting tired too, okay. "In my boardroom. Get out." And he was really angry, just shouting at her. I mean, because imagine that, you know, someone sitting meditation in a boardroom. And then she just stood up. She was totally unaffected by the anger and the blame. She was just meditating. Just, as I said, that when your string, the guitar string, is so loose, you just, nothing can upset you. So she just stood up and walked towards him. And he was just glaring, like some monster. And she went right up to him and she told me these words just came out of her mouth, you know, just unpremeditated, not willed, it just came out. And she said, "You have such beautiful blue eyes like my baby Holly back in Sydney." And she wasn't trying to be clever, it was actually really sincere. And that totally, the word is discombobulate. Which you may not know what the word actually means, but how it sounds is how it means. Just totally, his brain fused. Because when you've just been shouting at a person and glaring at them, "Get out of here," the last thing you expect is to be complimented on how beautiful your eyes are. And this poor CEO, she told me that, I remember her telling me this, and just he was just so confused, didn't know what to do. And for 1 or 2 minutes, he just totally not thinking because he didn't know what to make of this. And then his face softened and smiled. He said, "Really, I've got beautiful blue eyes." And had the contract signed in the next 5 minutes. And she just wanted to go back, got the contract signed, to go back to the hotel and take a rest, catch up on a jet lag before booking the next flight. But she told me the directors would not let her go. CEO gone out of the room, they formed a circle around her and said, "We're not letting you go until you tell us how you did that." That was so amazing. And so that's what happens if you don't accept anger or blame or violence. People just don't know what to do. You have them fully in your power. And she got that contract signed. Anyway, after a superb singing performance, are you talking about our chanting just now? The audience often says the singer and song have become one. In a similar situation, can we relate that to the meditative meditation? Yeah, you know, you're not there anymore. It's not separate. So yeah, but we go much deeper than just oneness. You know, that's, you know, we start, go from duality to oneness and from oneness to noneness. So, we disappear. Now, last question. Psychic powers were mentioned frequently. I wonder why no one yet has claimed the $1 million from James Randi should have been easy for the guy in prison. For the James Randi, that was $10,000. It wasn't $1 million. Has it gone up now? I don't know. But anyway, they wanted to try and prove psychic powers or something like that in laboratory conditions. Well, the point is that even if you did do something, they wouldn't acknowledge it happened, just like the flower pot experiment. No, it never happened. But it did. No, it didn't. Or you walk across Sydney Harbour on the water. No, it was a trick. Sometimes, and what are you doing that for anyway? You know, the trouble is that sometimes you want to try and prove it to somebody. This was the psychic powers of that fellow Edgar Cayce. You know, because he was doing miraculous cures, I was mentioning him yesterday, for so many people. It was in Virginia Beach, not far from Washington, New York, and many of these doctors, scientists, professors wanted to expose him as a fraud. You know, he was just tricking people. So they came down, and he was just very open to everything. So he went into a trance, and while he was in a trance, to prove that he was faking it, they put sort of slivers of wood between his fingernail and his flesh. And what they use to torture people, because it's incredibly painful apparently, and he didn't move, didn't flinch, he was in a trance. And they think, this is a real deal, he is really in a trance, it's amazing. And so they went back satisfied. They tried to disprove it, but it was real. But then their friend said, no, he tricked you. So his friends came down, and it wasn't just one person, they all wanted to prove that it was a fake. And after 5 or 6 times, his fingers got infected. Yeah, it didn't hurt while he was in trials, but it hurt like hell afterwards. And his fingers got all infected. He said, look, no more trying to prove this to anybody. Because people are so skeptical, they just will not believe it, even if it's right in front of their eyes. So that's why the psychic powers. And next, what do you want to try and prove it for anyway? People know themselves it's real. But there was the psychic power of remembering your past lives. This fellow Professor Ian Stevenson, he did such incredible research. You can't do better than that. But still people think, it's not real. And one of our friends, he went to go and visit Professor Ian Stevenson. And now Ian Stevenson invited him for dinner. We got signed copies of his work. I think it's in the Nolamara Library or somewhere. Was it in the Serpentine, Bodhinyana Library? But anyway, he signed copies, for us, for the monks at Serpentine, or the Buddhist Society of West Australia. But anyway, over dinner, he was just saying how disappointed he was and frustrated, because he was a psychologist, and his research. He wasn't even a Buddhist. He did the research, and just as objectively as you possibly could, he said, was that any other area of science? People have accepted that. It was really, high quality research. And he would, be a big lecturer, a big sort of hero. But just because of its nature of what he was trying to present, reincarnation, that was just so against, especially the dominant Christian religion in America at that time and still even now. No, it can't be true. So that's one of the problems there. People believe what they want to. So, even if you did do something, people wouldn't hand over the $1 million. Imagine that you could levitate. Imagine you could levitate. What would happen? They'd put you in a lab next to the rats and they'll try and prove that it was a fake. Trying to find out, you know, it's just where the wires are. Because it can't be true. Reading people's minds. If you could read people's minds, they did find out it was true. Then the CIA would recruit you to find out who really are the terrorists. You wouldn't need fake news anymore. You just interview Donald Trump and find out what he was really up to with those Russians. You wouldn't need... I remember this little... When I was a kid, there was a fellow who was reputedly able to predict the horse racing. And he did it once, twice, I think. And he got in the newspapers and he got kidnapped by the mafia. And just, you know, say, okay, predict the horse racing for us. He said, no, it's just luck, that's all. Just no coincidence. We don't believe you. They started torturing him. And just, that's what happens. You know, if you're anything out of the ordinary. So that's not a reason. No, that's not why we do psychic powers for. You know, for money. So we know we do it for something else. They're for service, compassion, kindness, not for money. Anyway, if we had such psychic powers, what we need to do with James Randi, we'd just go and buy a lot of chicken, that's all. No one would know about it. But you know what happened if you bought a lot of ticket? You'll find out, say, Ajahn Brahm, come on. You know, just Ajahn Brahm, I've been looking after you for such a long time. I just really need a lotto ticket as well. Please, come on. Can I have one as well? I'll tell the story of one of the nuns. Very quickly, and then last little story. There was a very famous nun, but I can't say what her name is, but, you know, many of you know, you'll find out. And she was teaching a meditation retreat in England. And after the retreat was finished, she was being driven to Heathrow Airport to get a flight back to where she was going to, and had to stop for lunch somewhere. And the place they chose to stop for lunch, you know, was a nice restaurant, but it was attached to a pub, an English pub. You had to actually walk through the bar to get into the restaurant. So quickly through the bar, and then to the restaurant, and they had a nice meal. And after paying for the meal, the driver had a few spare English coins. It wasn't enough to change at the airport in the currency exchange. So there was what they call the, in Australia, the pokey machines, the one-armed bandits. You just, you know, pull the lever, you put the coin, you pull the lever in, you know, the numbers go round, and if you sort of win something, the money comes out the bottom there. You know, they call them pokies in Australia, in different parts of the world. What do they call them? Slot machines? Yeah, well, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. So the driver was just putting the coins in, just to get rid of them, instead of, like, carrying them, not worth really exchanging. Put in the handle, put another coin in, pull the handle, put another... And that's when the nun walked past. And she said to the nun, she said, you know, you've got all the good karma, not me. You know, you're a nun, very famous, do good meditation. You pull the handle. And in a moment of mindlessness... The nun pulled the handle. Should never do that. Because what happened next? Numbers went around. No exaggeration. These stories are great. You know, you couldn't actually write them. People think they didn't happen, but they did happen. Jackpot. And all this money, all these £2 coins came flooding out of the machine over the nun's robe. They're not even allowed to touch the money, but it just came to her. Flowing. And at that, all the people in the bar stopped drinking and they fell silent. And the barman also just saw this strangely dressed nun with all this money winning the jackpot. He rang the little bell and announced to the nun that it was the custom, the rule, that if you won the jackpot, you would have to buy a drink for everybody who happened to be in the bar at the time. So not only this nun was covered in money, but also she had no choice but to buy gin and tonics and whiskies. For every, as in, she broke so many rules there. So that's why, don't do that. So let somebody else pull that lever for you. Don't give a lot of numbers or predict horse racing, because you're getting big trouble. So anyway, that is why that sometimes the monks say, do have psychic powers, with no way we're going to use them. Sadhu. 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 Very good. So anyway, have a nice night tonight.